Hello, this is Meet the Writers. I'm Georgina Godwin. My guest today is British, born in Eritrea to an Eritrean mother and an Ethiopian father. He spent his early life in a refugee camp in Sudan following the Hajar massacre in 1976. And in his early teens, he lived and studied in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia. He arrived in London as an underage, unaccompanied refugee without a word of English and went on to earn an MA in Development Studies from SOAS and a BSc in Economics from UCL. His first novel, The Consequences of Love, was shortlisted for the Commonwealth Writers' Prize, and it's been translated into more than 20 languages. He currently lives in Brussels, where he runs a writing academy for refugees. 10 years after his debut, he has a new book out, Silence is My Mother Tongue, a searing novel of love, judgment and sacrifice, and the powerful bonds forged in the crucible of refugee camp life. Suleiman Adonia, thanks so much for coming on to Meet the Writers.
Thank you so much for having me.
Such a long journey from where you started to publication day today when we're recording this of your brand new novel. And I want to take you right back to the beginning because it was a traumatic start in life. Tell me about your early days.
So my father is Ethiopian, my mother is Eritrean. They met in a border town between Ethiopia and Eritrea. They fell in love and they got married. And then when I was about 2, there was a massacre committed in Hajar, which is a border town on the Eritrean side of the border. And about 400 people were killed that day, including family members, which miraculously survived. And then soon after, masked men surrounded our hut in the middle of the night, asking for my father to come out. We didn't know why. He didn't know why. I was still about 2. So he refused to come out, and so they started shooting. My mother said that a bullet missed my brother, and that's when my father surrendered and he agreed to come out. So they took him away, and they basically smashed his head. He was paralyzed and soon after died. My mother decided she'd had enough, and so she left to the refugee camp in Sudan.
You were just 2 years old at the time.
I was 2 at the time. So, yeah, we fled by camels. And we ended up in this camp, which was mainly populated by Eritrean at the time.
And that's quite difficult, the dual heritage, the Ethiopian and Eritrean, because, of course, the conflict between the two nations.
It is. Actually, it's a fascinating story. So my father saw my mother in a market, and he fell in love with her, and he didn't know at the time that she was Eritrean. And the story goes that he followed her home and then he met her dad. And so he decided to marry her. And his father, he was an Ethiopian aristocrat, one of the wealthiest families actually in Gondar, quite a fertile Ethiopian region. So he said, no, you can't marry an Eritrean. So the relationship went really bad and he was almost disowned by his family. And I have the two sides. It's quite interesting to be from two warring sides, but it's also interesting to know that I'm here because of love.
It is a wonderful thing. And of course, love seems to be winning out a little bit more in that corner of the world. I mean, we're seeing a peace of sorts. What do you think about this treaty and what it says about the leadership of the sides involved?
When I first heard about it, I was absolutely delighted, especially for people living on the border town between these two countries. But once you started to dig deeper, you realize it's actually problematic because what do we mean by peace? Obviously, for Ethiopian, it's quite, you know, they have a democratic leader, prime minister, who's taking actions, who's trying to modernize the government. You know, his recent action was to have a 50-50 men and women in cabinet, which is something to applaud. But on the Eritrean side, what does it mean? We have a dictator who's been imprisoning his people for so many years. The definition of peace is quite different between the two sides. In a way, this peace process has given Isaias Afwerki, the president of Eritrea, a lifeline. It made him come out. He was almost demoralized because of the opposition. He's coming out right now, and he's feeling alive again because he's been welcomed by the international community. While we know that journalists are being imprisoned, tortured, some killed, people can't live freely in the country. When we look at what peace means for Eritrean, we're not quite there, I'm afraid.
Identity, of course, is what you write about in many ways, and your own identity. And I wonder what it is that you feel. You've written that writing is your home. And I guess that dual heritage feeds into that.
For so long, I've been thinking about identity as a way of belonging. But then I've decided, actually, what does it mean to belong anyway? Especially given my life story, going from one place to another and not quite having the full story of what really happened to family members, for example. For example, the story about my dad, I've only started to come to hear about it later in life because my mother is someone who doesn't really talk and she doesn't like to talk. And I can understand why. It's very traumatic experiences to talk about. So I've always been, I feel, going through life trying to find a place I call home, but I was finding myself going further and further from home. So I went from Eritrea to Sudan, from Sudan to Saudi Arabia, Saudi Arabia to London, and then London to Brussels. And so I'm at a stage of my life where I feel actually home is, writing is my place. I feel the happiest, I guess, when I write. And also, I feel that's my identity as a writer. I always say, like, when I came to the UK, for example, I thought I was a refugee. They said, no, you're an asylum seeker. And then 5 years later, I think it was, I was called Leave to Remain. And then 5 years after that, I was given the British citizenship and I was suddenly British. And then I've decided no one's going to make me into anything. I'm going to be a writer. And that's what I feel, a citizen of literature.
Mm-hmm. And of course, that forged very early on in the refugee camp. Now, you write about living in a camp in your latest book. We get a very clear idea of what it must have been like. What are your memories of that time?
I have so many memories. I was actually on the way here, I was thinking about the refugee camp, especially today. It's my publication day and I'm feeling very emotional. It's a place where I felt happy, first of all, because I was a child. But also it's a place where I lost my mother, for example, because she left to Saudi Arabia when I was 3. And I think one of the memories I cherish most are those days when I was silent. When my mother left, I didn't want to talk anymore. And that's why I called the book Silence is My Mother Tongue, because I felt with her departure, my mother tongue has left. And so I didn't want to talk. I felt silent for a while. And I was very lucky in that my grandmother was also a woman of few words. She didn't like to talk much herself. And I really appreciated that for her to give me the opportunity to be silent. And so silence is something I remember about the place, but also my childhood friends. We used to go to the forest to get water. We were happy, but also we were traumatized in a way, because as a child you see things and you hold on to those things. You see people suffering, but also you see people determined to make something out of their lives. And I was lucky to witness how they've managed to transform, for example, a refugee camp into a village. And that's something, my personality is a reflection of those days, in a sense that it took me 10 years to write this book. And there were a lot of moments of doubt and giving up, but I was just hold on to this idea that, no, I'm going to finish it. So being a child of refugee camp is interesting in that sense.
And of course, your mother made huge strides to try and make life better for everybody by going to Saudi Arabia. You joined her there eventually. Looking back both at Eritrea, which, as you say, is not a free country, and now at Saudi Arabia, which is a country with a very bad human rights record, yet a place that gave you sanctuary. How do you feel about that?
When I first came to Saudi Arabia, I was extremely happy. I was reunited with my mother. We lived together at the same place, But then I discovered, actually, she was a living servant working for a princess. And she was basically a modern-day slave. She would only be allowed to leave once a month, and that would be for a day. I was extremely upset by that, by the image I had that our life would be totally different, but the reality was completely opposite of what I thought it would be. But I had, Saudi Arabia is such a beautiful country, especially Jeddah. Coming from refugee camp to Saudi Arabia was just like, wow, this is a fantastic place. It's beautiful. I had food, I had really nice accommodation, all thanks to my mom. But then you go into the system, the education system, and you know that the whole country is geared towards making you into something which didn't quite fit with what I was at the time. I mean, I came from a refugee camp where the second wife of my father was Christian, for example, so I have Christian sisters. And, you know, I came from a background where the mother of one of my best friends was a sex worker. So it was a more tolerant place. I came and I found myself in Saudi Arabia, and day in, day out, it was this system that trying to make you into this kind of someone who doesn't appreciate tolerance, someone who is who would hate Christian, Muslim, I mean by Sufis, for example, Jewish. And so it was a place where I felt it was designed to make me hate. But then I was very lucky in that my brother loved reading, and my brother befriended a Sudanese intellectual who had access to banned novels. And so my brother brought home one of those novels, and it was the season Migration to the North by Sudanese novelist Taib Saleh, who lived in London in the 60s, I think. And that changed my life, reading it, because he was exploring themes that I thought were impossible for a young Muslim boy to explore. By that I mean sexuality, feminism, this idea of nuances about what the West means, as opposed to, oh, the West is just full of people who hate us, who want to do us harm. So I loved that, and it opened my mind. And since then, my brother and I started reading and taking risks, actually, to read those novels. And I was not even 12, 13. And that's why I find books are incredibly important, in the sense that they liberated me and they made me belong to the international community, as opposed to the Saudi system that was trying to isolate me from the international community and make me into something that I wasn't supposed to be.
You talked about your process of becoming British, but I wonder how you arrived in Britain and what that felt like. How old were you? Because you didn't speak English at the time. It must have been incredibly difficult.
I was about 15 when I came to this country. It was difficult, but also an opportunity. I saw it an opportunity. I'm going to be in a place that will allow me to regain my humanity. And I always think of London, actually, as a bridge to my childhood, in the way I immediately noticed, for example, at the time, the first place we lived was in Kilburn High Road, and I would see temple, mosque, synagogue, Christian, Jewish, Muslim, and I felt that street that goes all the way from Kilburn High Road to Edgware Road, the most peaceful street ever, because this was, I felt, my God, this is life, this is incredible, in a sense that you've got a community from all over the world coming and coexisting peacefully. So I love the love side to it, I love the humane side to it, but I also love the intellectual side to it, in the sense that you could see differences. You could see differences and think about them, tolerate them. And if you don't, you can't say no. And then all the way I went to, for example, to Hyde Park Speaker Corner, which for me was, I used to go there almost every Sunday. I listened to all those people saying bad things about the Queen, which also, my God, this would not pass in a place like Saudi Arabia, for example. I remember black, Asian, white coming together and saying whatever they felt was right. And so that was, for me, a beautiful, beautiful experience to have at the time. But yeah, the difficulties came later, because you suddenly realize that you have to look after yourself, because you're not with your parents. So if anything goes wrong, you have to really take care of yourself. You have to love yourself. You have to make decisions for yourself. And also learning the language was extremely difficult, but walking helped me at that time, and I always felt like London was my best friend at the time, because I felt I could talk to the streets. It was a language, in a sense, that there was a dialogue of silence between me and the streets. You know, wherever I walked, I felt, I love this. I feel like, okay, those buildings are talking to me. It's this idea that sometimes loneliness can really help you transcend and find home in home and languages in places you wouldn't normally otherwise think of them as home or languages.
You went on and you got not one, but two degrees. Obviously, by now your English was fluent. Tell me where your first book, The Consequences of Love, came from.
Walking. I remember at the time I lived in King's Cross. I was working on a different idea. I was working on a novel set in London with underage children from different parts of Africa. But it was too complex to write, and agents were rejecting it. And I remember meeting my first agent at the time, and he said, "I'm sorry, it's too complex for you to do at the moment. It's your first novel, and I like something quite simpler." Usually was my debut novelist. And I was just walking from his office, and suddenly this idea came to me about Nasser and Fiori when I was walking. And again, I felt like, okay, if I want to explore anything in Saudi Arabia, it would be through love, in a sense that we associate Saudi Arabia a place of oppression, and it is. But what I found it very interesting at the time was how, for example, women were the path to freedom and love, in a sense that they were veiled, but they could see boys. One of the things that came to me as I was walking, this memory of girls in Saudi Arabia dropping notes, love notes, at boys' feet. And I thought, okay, this is a simple thing, and I would love to create a story around it. I got to Gower Street around SOAS, and the pink shoes just came to me, and I felt, my God, this is it, this is it. So I wrote the synopsis quickly. I sent it to him, and he called me. He said, "I love this, and I think this would be a great novel," and he signed me based on that synopsis.
And of course, it is a great novel and has done very, very well, translated into over 20 languages, shortlisted for the Commonwealth Writers' Prize. It then took you 10 years to write your next book.
Yeah.
Why?
I moved to Brussels. That's one thing.
And you started running writing courses for refugees and asylum seekers.
Yeah, that was later, after actually I come to finish the book. But at the beginning, when I moved to Brussels, I moved to Brussels with the idea of the novel. I had the idea of novel set in London. And suddenly, first of all, I felt all my childhood traumas came. And I think it was the first time where I had the money, because The Consequences of Love was doing quite well. And so my partner, who is Belgian, and I bought this place in Brussels. And so I felt like I had time, and it wasn't like head down and just work and survive and try to learn languages or trying to teach yourself how to write and all that. So I had time, and suddenly I felt myself overwhelmed by all what had happened to me as a child. And so it took me a while to understand what was happening. And so I've isolated myself, and out of that isolation came a different direction in the way I went to write. And I'm really happy, because I felt at the time I didn't want to do a sequel to The Consequences of Love. I wanted to do something quite different, something drastic in the way I approach writing has really changed. And then, because I'm self-taught in everything I do, I try to read so many books in terms of, I decided if I'm going to carry this idea in the way this shape of the novel, the structure of the novel, in the way I wanted to do, I had to learn how to write differently than what I did with The Consequences of Love. And I did. And I read so many books by different writers. And I got to a point where I felt comfortable, okay, of carrying this novel. But then it was about another thing I decided at the time, or I observed at the time, that I couldn't do some of the characters justice, because I had obstacles in my head. And those obstacles, I realized, they were created through the society, what the society taught me about taboos, for example. I decided to completely erase them, try to break the boundaries between the conscious and the subconscious, for example. I wanted to be in a position, if a character asked me to do something that I felt as a human being, no, I can't do this, I want to be in a position to say, okay, I'll do it. I wanted to be in a position to go wherever the characters take me. And to do that, I had to free myself, reprogram my mind. And so there was a lot of psychological work happening before I actually started writing, or being in a position to say, okay, I'm ready. Once my characters knew that I was ready to match whatever they want me to do, I think it was fluent after that.
And you also immersed yourself in painting. I know that the works of the Impressionists are hugely important to you, and particularly Degas, and how you can see that in the book. Imagine the woman bathing picture. You absolutely describe that, but in a completely different way. This taking place not in Paris, but in a dusty refugee camp in Sudan.
I love Degas. I love paintings. It's my passion. sometimes I would wake up at 3, 4 a.m. just to look at paintings. And because, well, I started to get interested in paintings because when I came to the UK and my brother and I didn't speak English, you look at the painting and you see a language. Like I said, with the street of London, you really have to find, in order to survive those days, you have to find language in places or subjects or objects where you feel they are human beings. And I felt like you look at a painting and you feel you transcend, you try to think about it, you enter into a dialogue. And that's what those lonely days make you want to do, enter into a dialogue. And so I carried that through to my Brussels years. And with Degas, for example, when I saw the painting of women, a woman bathing, I felt like, wow, that was like a spark. And I felt, I'm going to paint this woman in words. And it was a challenge. And it took me 10 years to do it, but I'm glad I did.
It's an extraordinary book. It's so beautifully written. It questions what it means to be a man, to be a woman, to be an individual when circumstances have forced the loss of absolutely everything that makes a home and the possibility of a future. There's also a wonderfully unique relationship between the brother and the sister in the book. The brother is gender fluid in a way that's almost impossible to categorize. And I wonder what you were exploring with that.
I was exploring many things, I think. First of all, I was exploring how is it a society it doesn't see Haggis and he is openly celebrating his sexuality. And I felt this fluidity of his sexuality in terms that he feels a man and a woman at the same time. I was thinking, is it because he's disabled? In a way, in our culture, for example, if you're disabled, the society doesn't see you. And I felt, is it because his disability was like a curtain that kind of separated him from the society and him is being his true self? And then I realized, there's a problem with the society in the way we box people and how once you free yourself from that society, you can really be who you want to be. For example, if you see with Saba, she's more masculine than feminine, for example, but they see her. And they challenge her and they notice her and they always go, you're not acting like a girl, you're not acting like a girl, you're not being feminine enough. And so to me, it was an opportunity to explore the rigidness and the way a society tries to box people. And I wanted to celebrate individuality. I think for us, especially in Africa, we value solidarity above individuality. And I think it's time to step back and celebrate us individually, that we are different. You know, some of us are transsexual, some of us are transgender, some of us sexually feel different, some of us emotionally feel different. We just are different people. And I felt in a places like a camp, for example, the whole society has to move in one place. And so to me, it was an opportunity to celebrate our sexuality, our desires, that yes, we live in a refugee camp, we shouldn't be the same. So it was a conversation between us, first of all.
To end, I want to go back to the beginning and talk about individuals, but one particular individual, your father, whom you lost, who I know that you have no photographs of.
No.
And you have a wonderful plan to try and capture that, and I guess to try and capture some spirit of home.
I've always wondered what he looked like, my dad, because he passed when I was 2, so I can't remember what he looked like. And so there's a huge gap. And then when my son was born, who's 9 now, and he kept asking me about my father, before he started talking, I felt like having him in my life, it felt quite surreal. And it just reminded me like, oh my God, I remembered my father. And so I already had this idea of going back home. I said to myself, okay, I need a picture of my dad. And one way of doing it is actually to go back home with a sketch artist and ask people to describe from their memory how he looked like. And so a sketch artist would, based on the sketch and a picture of my dad. There are 2 things about that. One is that I know memories fade and change. And so whatever the sketch artist would make out of their memories, it's not going to be an accurate picture. So I like the uncertainty about it. And I also like the fact that to bring my dad, but to bring him back in a way through the imagination of people, through memories of people. And I think that's quite surreal, but it's beautiful at the same time.
Suleiman, I really hope you find your father.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for this beautiful book. It's called Silence is My Mother Tongue. It's published by the Indigo Press, and it's by the wonderful Suleiman Adonia.
Thank you so much for having me.
You've been listening to Meet the Writers, thanks to the production team of George McDonough, Christy Evans, Kenya Scarlett and Barbara Maimoni. You can download this show and previous episodes from our website or app, from SoundCloud, MixCloud or iTunes. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.